Welcome to the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Civil Law. We're now in session. We're going to hear the measures today in the order that they are on the agenda. There is the proceedings are also being transmitted to H.R. 243, so that would be an overflow room for any of you that wish to watch it on video or don't have an opportunity to have a seat here. 343. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2157A and call as our first three witnesses Tricia Whitfield, Representative Cameron, and Representative Galizio. And while they're taking their positions, we'll have counsel explain the bill.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2157 comes to you from the Department of State Police. This bill provides some agencies with authority to request nationwide fingerprint-based background checks from the FBI. It also authorizes state licensing boards to request these background checks for those applying for a license or certificate. It streamlines the process for background checks performed by the Oregon State Police, and it requires all agencies to adopt administrative rules that fully address circumstances when nationwide background checks will be required. It also directs the FBI and the Oregon State Police to destroy fingerprint cards and facsimiles following a background check. You have provided to you quite several amendments, dash A3 through A13. Most of these amendments include different agencies that want to be included within the provisions of this bill. I want to point out the dash A6 amendments. Those are some cleanup amendments, and also the dash A8 amendments are do some further cleanup and technical changes.
Thank you, counsel. Before we proceed with the testimony, although we have four bills to consider today, at least two are fairly controversial and will require some extensive public hearings. We will shoot to adjourn about 10:30 because session begins at 10:45. On this particular bill, I have 11 witnesses. I have 11 people favoring the bill. I have no opposition, apparently. I hope you keep that in mind as you testify, because if we run out of time, we're going to have to go to session, and we won't be back till Wednesday, and it's late in the session, so to get your bills out, we're going to have to be relatively brief. So with that, I'll have our first panel commence their testimony.
Good morning, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. For the record, I am Patricia Whitfield, Director of Oregon State Police Identification Services Section. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2157A concerning state and nationwide criminal history record checks. The purpose of this bill is to provide a streamlined process for non-criminal justice background fingerprint checks for agencies when authorized by the legislature. The bill cleans up some existing statutes currently dealing with background checks. House Bill 2157 allows for agencies with current statutory authority to gain future access with a read with statement. Section 2 specifically of the bill is the common process, the blanket process, as you will, to provide that streamlined process. Over the past several years, many agencies have drafted legislation to gain access to state and nationwide background checks. And in some cases, the legislation was passed only to find out that the agencies sort of came up short. They were not able to do those nationwide checks because the language in the statute did not meet the FBI's requirements. And in other cases, agencies had used existing language authority for other agencies that didn't somehow fit, causing some confusion to the process. The FBI has approved the language in House Bill 2157A, so we know that will ensure success for any agencies that this legislative body approves the authority in the future. And that can all be accomplished in Section 2. Sections 3 through 68 essentially brings together most of the agencies that are currently doing background checks and again, bringing a standard process, applying what they're doing to the Section 2 as a common process. These sections also include a number of agencies that are for first time asking for authority to gain access to criminal history record information. In some cases, many of these agencies already have some sort of access through governor's executive order, but they do not have the authority to do an FBI nationwide check. Section 69 repeals various statutes as a result of the housekeeping process that this bill was crafted for, and Section 70 adds an emergency clause upon passage in order to address some fee issues that are within some of the agency's current statutes. Oregon State Police has worked with a number of agencies, several groups, to gather input and further improve the bill that will hopefully provide a streamlined process that will work better for everyone in the future, now and in the future. Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, that concludes my testimony. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Fine. Thank you for your testimony. We'll save the questions until the panel has concluded its testimony. Who's next?
Morning, Chair Ackerman. Morning. Members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Cameron, District Representative from District 19, State Representative from District 19. And I want to come here in support of this bill today. And the first thing I'd like to share with you is we have spent, Representative Galizio and I have spent many hours with a work group of 40 or more people getting this bill into the condition of where it is today before you. And so there's been a lot of work that's gone into it. Basically, I have a personal story that I want to share. I was appointed to District 19, 6 weeks behind everybody. In the first week in committee, I happened to be on two committees, Health and Human Services and General Government, and we were hearing these fingerprint bills in different committees. And I was amazed at one story as I heard the medical board examiners in front of us giving testimony about doctors that are coming here from out of state and setting up shop. And they did not have the ability and were not doing federal background checks on doctors. And we all know of a recent story in the news that doctors have been actually doing some very poor practices and actually killing people as a result, moving from state to state. So I was just kind of shocked that we weren't able to do that at this point in time, and so we needed the state's authority to be able to allow them to do federal background check. That, and we were listening to other groups having bills put forward, we recognized that we needed to bring these things together and have some way to, really important for us as state representatives in this, protect the public that we serve. And then the secondary issue here is to protect the individual's rights who are having to go forth and have these fingerprints taken. So I want to explain that there's been a lot of work to get to this point to balance those two issues. And the other thing is that I have been on record to formally request the Speaker to consider appointing an interim committee to fully examine this complex topic here in our state and all the issues and concerns that couldn't be met during this busy legislative session. And I think it's important. There is another state, I believe it's Virginia, that has a clearinghouse role model, a model that they've set up, that we look at some other ways, because as you're seeing before you today, there's, I think, 13 amendments. There's going to be a need as we move forward for other agencies to have the ability to do limited federal background checks, and they're going to need that statutory authority, and we need to have a system that's going to protect the rights of individuals. A couple of items that are still of concern that I'll put on the record is, how do we allow local governments to access the nationwide background checks for non-criminal justice purposes? How do we make this process user-friendly for those who submit fingerprints today? Interesting story. We won't go into that today, but we are going to start a business. the role of independent fingerprinters in Oregon that now operate with little oversight. That's another issue. These are side issues that came up as we've been exploring this. Is the public being served in the best way, and are we doing all we can to ensure public safety in this area? Should we explore the need for a central clearinghouse, as I referred to other states are doing, to aid in the oversight and fingerprinting and efficiencies through our government processes? Today I sit here before you and voice support of the bill, and the amendments that are in front of you up through A8 we have reviewed, and some of those amendments came late. We did not want to hold this process up. And I'm going to ask Representative Glizio to talk about some of the improvements that we made in the measure during the work group process.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Larry Glizio, Representative, House District 35. Good morning. And I worked with Representative Cameron and Tricia Whitfield as part of it. From the general government, we had a work group on this bill. It became complex, and we had about 40 people. And I just thought I would talk about some of the changes that we made at the General Government Committee and then go from there. But what we did on our work group for this was, first, we included state agencies and organizations who came to us expressing what we perceived as a valid need for some kind of fingerprint-based background checks for employees and volunteers. Secondly, we wanted to require that all of these groups adopt strict administrative rules that address, and specifically, in what circumstances fingerprints and the nationwide background checks would be required, and also how the findings would be used and why they are necessary for public safety. I don't think anyone here or in the state wants a fishing expedition. So there needs to be a justification for the need for and the use of fingerprinting. And I feel very strongly about that, as did people in the work group. We eliminated references to local government. As Representative Cameron mentioned, that was discussed, but within the work group, we felt like there wasn't a sort of a cogent enough explanation as to the process that would take place among local governments, and we didn't think we had the time to take care of that within the session, so we just eliminated references to that in the bill. We wanted to provide consistent language in the bill so that like agencies would be treated equally. A very important part was requiring the destruction of the fingerprint cards and the facsimiles by the state police and the FBI. I'm sure that'll be a part of a discussion. Of course, we don't have authority or jurisdiction over the FBI, last I checked, but that is the charge, at least from the state and from in the bill. Also, we, in the work group, put language to provide agencies with a means to collect the fees to cover the expense of conducting a nationwide background check. And just setting the fee, the fee was such that it just would cover the expense, and it wasn't sort of a revenue-generating element. Also, with DHS, who's had extensive experience in this type of, with this process, they discussed their appeal process for contested cases, and that's a very important element of the bill. So trying to standardize any kind of appeal process, that's what we look to do. And two more elements that we did in the general government work group. TriMet came to us. They had to meet homeland security requirements, so we added language to allow TriMet to indeed meet those requirements. And also, we instructed the Board of Nursing and DHS to share the results of their checks when both required fingerprints of the same individual, thus reducing the expense for the applicant. So those are some of the actions that we took and tried to include in the bill. A couple things I just wanted to mention. Number one is I have not even looked at, but apparently there are several amendments, I guess 8 through all the way to 12 or 13. I have not even looked at those, so just not going to comment, but I've just not looked at those. We had quite a deliberative process and a work group, and as Representative Cameron mentioned, there were some 40-some-odd, well, there were different groups, and I felt like we had a good discussion, and that was critical. So, again, I can't really comment on those, on the latter amendments. And I would end with saying that I'm sure everyone wants to try to, you know, that difficult balance of public safety and privacy rights, and trying to create that balance, and it's quite a challenge, and I would agree with Representative Cameron that some kind of an interim work group is really needed as we go forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Does the committee have any questions of the panel? I have a couple to start it off. In the engrossed bill, you continue the language as defining a state agency pursuant to ORS 174.111. When you read that statute, it includes all agencies of the or three branches of government, judicial, executive, and legislative. It seems to me that everyone then within those agencies would come within the scope of this bill. And now we have, with the up to the Dash 13 amendments, agencies trying to opt in rather than trying to opt out. So I'm trying to figure out, what are you doing here? Do you intend to include everyone within 174.11, or should we take that out and let people opt in?
Chair Ackerman and members of the committee, I'll try to answer that question. The purpose of the Section 2 of the bill, again, is to provide the process. It isn't a requirement that the agencies mentioned in the authorized agency definition perform these checks, but rather outline who that might be. Then in the individual agency statutes themselves, it would be up to those agencies to make their case and request specifically what types of checks they want to do and whether the legislature approves that or not. So Section 2 provides the definition and the means to do the check, but then the other part of it is the read with an agency, again, requesting their own access, would have that addressed by the legislative body for their agency and point back to Section 2 as the process. Does that help answer?
I don't think the question was addressed, and I don't need to belabor it. If it's a structural problem, we can have council look at it and maybe suggest amendments we can present to the full committee. I don't mean to stop the bill because of this, but I just think that there's a structural problem because you're including all agencies of all agencies of the legislature, of the executive branch and judicial branch. You define that as an authorized agency, and so that covers everybody. Covers everybody. And if you don't intend that, we'll take that out, and you can have people come in by, you know, up to Dash 13 or up to 25 amendments if you need to.
Chair, I don't have the legal knowledge to look at it, but I know the intent was to set up a process for all agencies because they have to have the expressed stated authority from this body to be able to do the background checks through the FBI. So the Section 2 does not give them the authority to do that. It just sets up the process that they all fall under once they are granted the authority. That's the intent of Section 2, because as we looked at this, there were all kinds of different ways people were proceeding. For example, DHS was getting fingerprints back and destroying them at DHS. And we said, no, any agency that comes under this bill, once they have the authorization, will follow the procedures in Section 2, i.e. now the state police will stop and destroy all fingerprints. And so Section 2 just allows the process to set up. The rest of the sections give them the implicit authority to come under Section 2. That's the intent of the bill. So we probably should have council make sure that's the way it's...
Okay. Further discussion on this point, I think we'll let council look at this for you and get back to you to see if there is a technical change we need to make. I still think that there is. Okay. Okay. Any other questions? Representative Girard. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you had time to review the Dash 5s?
I'm not sure. I think we saw everything up through Dash 8. I can't remember. What was 5?
5 is holding the district and the employee immune from civil liability for the lawful dissemination of information obtained under this section.
Which,
and that kind of scares me.
Which is specific to page 50. It's probably specific to one agency.
49, yeah.
Mr. Chair.
You're right, it is on page 50. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, I was just, it's just been indicated to me, I don't have it in front of me, but this was the TriMet amendment and concern, and I don't know if TriMet's going to testify, so
I'll still be here.
Perhaps that would, yeah.
Okay. Okay, further questions of the committee? I have a couple more. Just as a general theme, an agency would have the authority to request a check of a prospective employee or even someone that it may do business with, such as an outside vendor. How do we know, how do these people know that the check is being requested?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, I believe within the process you'll find that there is a requirement that the applicant must be notified of the background check and that fingerprints would be included.
Is that in the bill?
Yes, I don't know off
Pardon?
The top of, I don't know off the top of my head which section it is, but I believe it is in there. There's also current statute for non-criminal justice background type checks. I believe it's 181555 that also requires for agencies that are authorized to notify the applicant prior to a background check.
Okay. I will look for that. If somebody could pick that out for me or some other witness can tell me, can answer that. I didn't find it in my quick review of the bill. How do you know? And I think that's pretty important because, you know, your livelihood is going to be subjected to a criminal backgrounds check, and I think you should know that's going to happen, and I think you should know what the result is. Obviously, you know if you're going to be fired or terminated. I have another question on page 3 regarding the contested case process, and this is when an individual may appeal a determination is based upon the records presented. What bothers me, and I'd like some discussion on this, is that challenges to the accuracy and completeness of the information provided by this Department of State Police and FBI and related data are not subject to challenge through the contested case process. So in other words, you go to a contested case process, you've lost your job, they have a criminal record that you cannot challenge in any way through the contested case process. That means that the government's conclusions on this matter are conclusive. I have a problem with that. Can you tell me what the purpose was or what the debate was regarding the insertion of that language?
Representative Chair Ackerman, you're talking about lines 36 through 45 on page 3. Is that section 14A? That is set up, and we had testimony from DHS that they have an appeals process, and I believe it was 50%.
Mm-hmm.
There was somewhere around 50% that they have people who have appealed because of whatever reason. They go through this process, 50% of those appeals are overturned. 50% are upheld because they still don't qualify for whatever the situation is based on the rules and the outline that DHS has set up for those jobs. So 36 through 45 is the second, is my outlet if I'm denied originally for the process, for my job based on that. Now I can go through this process that each agency comes under this has to set up a process that allows people to go through and appeal. And obviously if I am turned down on that appeal, then I'm turned down. But there is an appeals process, and that's what this ensures. Established by rule, a contested case process that a subject individual may appeal for the determination, the original determination.
I don't know if that also answers my question. My question is, in that process, the documents upon which the determination is made from the state police or FBI cannot be challenged in a contested case process. And I'm wondering, a hypothetical would be there's a fingerprint match, and the fingerprint match shows that the applicant has been convicted of a crime, and he's disqualified from employment. But suppose in that fingerprint match it's not completely identical, and there's a margin of error going back and forth. Should the applicant be able to challenge that to the contested case process? And doesn't this sound like the Patriots Act case in Portland, where the lawyer was arrested and incarcerated for a considerable period of time based upon a faulty fingerprint match which linked him with the terrorism acts and it occurred in Spain? And he couldn't challenge that, okay, until they finally caved at the end. But there was a misidentification because of a fingerprint.
Chair Ackerman.
How do we accommodate the innocent?
I can't speak on the contested case process, but I can tell you that if there's any question or challenge on criminal history information, as mentioned here, it does go through the state police and or the FBI, depending on where the source is. That's also in statute in our administrative rule, but there's always a means for the subject of a record to challenge that information. And if it came to the point where the fingerprints were challenged, then that process in place as well.
I can think of another hypothetical where there's a persons have the exact identical first, middle, and last name. I've been involved in some wrongful arrest cases where you extract that from the state agency. The state agency issues arrest for the wrong person, but it's by the same name. And I worry about that type of information that I can understand how those things would happen, but the applicant should be able to challenge that and say, that's not really me.
Right. Chair Ackerman, I have the same reservations. We heard some situations about that, but those are unique situations that I think we need to have a process, and sometimes that process takes longer to ensure public safety on the broader scale. And those are situations with a bill like this. I know we're not going to eliminate every single situation that's going to be a potential conflict, and there are individuals that may have to work harder to go through this process, but I think that's just the nature of what happens when we're trying to balance the protection of the general public with the protection of individuals as well. And sometimes there's going to be situations that hopefully we have processes. They take longer to do the due diligence, though.
Okay, further questions from any other questions from the committee? I'm wondering also, let me just get another one out here, that if this comes back that the subject individual has a criminal record which would impair his or her employment, the authorized agency has the authority to terminate that person. It seems like they have no middle ground, such as putting a person on some sort of probationary status. It just seems like it's black and white. If the background check comes out against you and the agency makes a determination under the rules that you're unfit for work, which is or not fit to hold the position, there's no middle ground here. Either you're going to get fired or you're going to be retained. Have you considered whether the agency should have some sort of progressive discipline here rather than that this black and white approach?
Chair Ackerman, can you which part of the bill are you referring to? Because
I think I'm at the top of page 3. An authorized agency using the rules under this subsection shall determine whether the subject individual is fit to hold a position, provide services, or be employed, or be granted the license, certification, or registration based upon the criminal records check. So basically, if I had a criminal conviction sometime in the past, and yet it fit the parameters of the rules that you could consider it, you could revoke my license.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my understanding and what my hope would be is that the language is such that ultimately, you know, you can't have a technical fix for everything, and at some level, human beings are going to be making decisions. So when it talks about if a subject individual is determined to be unfit, so there, that is the point at which the agency must, number one, there must be a justification as to why the particular criminal record is relevant. In other words, there has to be some judgment there. And it is, there's always a concern that there can be an abuse. But ultimately, it's in the agency's interest to, number one, protect public safety. But at the same level, if there's something in the background that is ruled and determined by agency members that is not, does not justify termination, is maybe something that happened in the past, but it was long enough ago, or it's just not particularly relevant, they should be able to make that determination. So I don't know how you codify in statute good judgment. And to my understanding is that the determination is going to be made by people, and at a certain level, that's what you're going to have to do. You can't codify good judgment in statute.
Well, you could leave it up to the discretion of the individual agency and allow them to do something less than termination or revocation of a permit or license. I don't know that you're doing that here. It seems like it's a pretty black and white test.
Chair Ackerman, I'd like to comment on that. And where we're reading in Section 11, actually, that's the fitness determination section that each agency is going to set up. And it refers back to even Section 9, where, for example, an agency that's hiring janitors for mopping their floors and cleaning bathrooms is probably not going to set up authority from the expense and all those. I mean, that person doesn't need to be fingerprinted on a federal background. And so as the agency, and I think you might hear from DHS today, hopefully, when we say that there's been 50% overturned, that's a good number. I'm glad to hear that number, and the fact that people have the option to come forward and say, is that crime that I committed 20 years ago still relevant today? And maybe DHS had a confining rule that somebody wasn't looking at. So this process outlined from 9 to 11 does allow the agency the flexibility to say, we're going to make our own rules. We're not going to disqualify somebody from a job just because they had a certain crime 20 years ago and it doesn't apply to this job today. That's one way we have flexibility. The other way is through the review process. Mm-hmm. So there is flexibility built in for the agencies to be able to do that through the rules.
I understand the intent. I just don't see the language that incorporates that good faith judgment where the agency would have the discretion to consider a lesser sanction and a termination or revocation. But we can get back to that. I mean, these are things that can be cured. My last question is based upon the staff summary that says this bill was designed to investigate persons in positions of public trust that deal with vulnerable populations and sensitive information. I don't see that in the Act. I see this as, you know, you can get a background check on the janitor, or you can get a background check on a vendor, someone that does business with your with the public agency. Did you intend that this bill was going to be that narrowly constructed, or do you intend this broader approach?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, great challenge. In other words, difficult. It's very difficult in statute to be so specific for each agency. At the same time, of course, there was an attempt not to be so broad. So, again, the idea of nexus, in other words, there needs to be some kind of justification for it. To the extent that it is in the bill, then we were successful, but it's a challenge, and I think it's a challenge that we face, and it's faced at all levels of government, is how do you, in language, create it in a way that is not overly broad, yet not so specific where we have to have, where it makes it almost impossible to act because you have to continually add specific positions in statute. So there was certainly knowledge that that was a challenge, and there was an attempt to be made to require that there's justification for a background check.
What justification could you show that language? Right now, it's just, as I see it, the agency just arbitrarily can say, I want a background check on someone. Is there a parameter?
Yeah. Well, I think you mentioned some of, you know, in other words, well, maybe since Representative Cameron has the bill, we could talk about some of the language.
Chair Ackerman, in Section 2 is where the agency has to, before they can apply, before they can go to the state police and say, we want to start doing fingerprint background checks, they have to set up, go through the process, like DHS has and other agencies already, go through the process of saying, these are the positions we're going to fingerprint for, these are the rules that we're going to follow. And to answer your previous question, for example, under Section 9, page 2, Section 9, each authorized agency with the state police, but the last line, the rules shall include but not be limited to the following rules. An agency could, in fact, I highlighted A, determining when and under what conditions a subject individual may be hired on a preliminary basis while we're doing that background check, defining the conditions under which the subject individual may participate in training. So they could add a rule there saying, you know, we're going to, based on a 30-day period, there is flexibility in here for an agency to move towards the direction you talked about previously. And then on the flip side, the constraining process up front is in their rulemaking process.
I got you.
So once they made the rules, then they can go to the state police and say, we want to do these checks on these people, not on everybody.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Gerard.
I'm wondering if my earlier question ties in here somewhere, but you're holding those that conduct these checks harmless from any kind of accountability. Am I reading this right?
In that that was, that particular language was under the section for I believe the Metro amendment, wasn't it?
TriMet.
That amendment you were referring to either earlier, mm-hmm. Representative Gerard?
Yes, well, what I'm saying is it apparently applies to everybody in the entire bill.
Well, obviously, if I...
It says a district and an employee of the district, but it's not defining it a particular district.
That amendment is referring to on page 50 for under the Metro Transportation District. In specific, that amendment is. But if that applied to the whole process, I'm not an attorney and I haven't read the legal language there, but I'm assuming that they have to follow these procedures. If they don't follow these procedures that are outlined, then obviously those liabilities are off the, you know, off the table. I mean, that protection.
Follow, Mr. Chair?
Yes, you may.
Okay, if that's just applicable to TriMet, but tell me on the bill then, for all these folks that now can follow the rules and conduct checks, what accountability is on those people that they don't abuse and misuse that power? What check is in here? Who holds them accountable?
Representative, that's a good question. I've been asking since I got here several weeks ago about a lot of issues. And, you know, it's this body and the people that hire are responsible for hiring and putting directors in positions. In those positions, I mean, we've got to do the best we can, but once we walk out this door, they have got to be charged to do the right thing. And if somebody's abusing their power or their situation, then they need to be dealt with in a timely and correct manner, just like anybody else would.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, you may.
But they're not allowed, if somebody has a check on them and something comes up bad, they're not allowed to challenge it. So how does the system work to catch somebody who's abusing, you see?
They are, Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Gregg, they are allowed to challenge it. They are allowed to come back and say, if I applied for a job and I was denied because of my jaywalking violation 20 years ago, or whatever the situation is, I am allowed to challenge it through these rules and say, I want to challenge my denial of that employment under this process.
Okay, first question from the committee.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
I'm understanding Representative Garrard's question a little differently. In other words, sort of who's watching the watchers?
Yes.
And if there's no liability or accountability for the watchers, the agencies, then that's problematic. My understanding and the intent was that you try to create a process, but I concur with you. I mean, there needs to be accountability at all levels. So to the extent, I mean, that needs to be in there as well. So my understanding, and again, I hope it's accurate, was that was specific to the Dash 5 amendment, but if it's a problem throughout, then I'm with you. I think that's a concern.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Representative. Are there further questions from the committee to this panel? I got hands from the panels.
Mr. Chair,
right,
I just want to point out your previous question about whether the applicant is knowledgeable of whether a background check is going to be conducted. Page 4, lines 14 through 17, do address that.
Page 4, what was the first line?
It's subsection 17 on line 14 through 17. It's referring to the authorized agency's application form must contain notice that the person is subject to fingerprinting and a criminal records check.
Okay. Further comments from the panel then?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for letting us be here today. I just want to make one more endorsement that the A6 and the A8 amendments are those which came from our general government committee. And we would encourage you to adopt those amendments in the bill as well. They were technical fixes, and we agreed upon those. But we did not want to hold this bill up. We think it's important for the public safety of the state of Oregon to move this bill. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you, and appreciate your testimony. I'll call up the next panel, and I will state that I said there was no opposition to this bill. The American Civil Liberties Union is in opposition. Ms. Meyer didn't check yes or no on the sign-in sheet, so I said originally there was no opposition. That was uncharacteristic, but nonetheless, that I'll correct the record to that extent. Let's see who we need next. Is it Lisa Zavala, Margie Lowe, and Olivia Clark? Three folks want to come forward. You might keep in mind some of the questions we've raised, even if you have to deviate from your testimony to meet the concerns of the committee. You may proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lisa Zavala with the Oregon University System. Chair Ackerman, we had watched the bill as it proceeded through the General Government Committee, and like you, had the impression that Section 2 would in fact cover the university system as a state agency. But under advice from our Attorney General's office, We are seeking amendments in the form of the A7 amendments to include us in this bill. We do recruit and hire faculty, staff from throughout the country and sometimes internationally, and also we have vendors on our campuses and volunteers that we would like to have the ability to perform background checks on. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Next.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Margie Lau. I'm the interim executive director of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. I came to the commission about 8 months ago when the agency was in a very severe financial difficulty around its student loan program. In that process, we worked with a number of individuals from the Department of Administrative Services, Human Resources, and Labor Relations in order to go through a process of reducing the staff by two-thirds in the agency. I came to the Student Assistance Commission from the Department of Human Services, and so was already aware of many of the ways in which the Student Assistance Commission partners with the Department of Human Services as well as schools throughout the state. I was surprised as we were working through the process related to all the employees to discover that there were no background checks required of the employees of the Student Assistance Commission, even though the agency has employees who are handling very sensitive student records placed in school buildings and in Department of Human Services locations across the state, and also working with a lot of, in fact, millions of dollars of donor funds that we hold in trust for scholarships. As I was doing the work with the staff around the process, one of the things that I discovered in working with folks is that even though this is a relatively small agency, before the reductions had fewer than 100 staff, that in the last 5 years, there had been 3 convicted sex offenders on that staff, some of them with access to school buildings, all of them with access to the student records. In talking with the folks at the Department of Administrative Services, they said that the agency should have the safeguards but would need statutory authority, and so they encouraged me to seek assistance through 2157 to allow the agency to be able to provide these safeguards to students, schools, our donors, and our other partner agencies. I'd be glad to answer any questions the committee might have, and hope that we could all support 2157 with the -A4 amendments. That's the one that actually adds in the Student Assistance Commission.
Fine, thank you. Next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Olivia Clark, the Executive Director of Government Affairs for TriMet, and I've asked to come to the table with me Helen Colliner, who's from the Legal Department at TriMet, to answer some of the more complex questions here. We are already, in the Ann Gross bill, and the authority that the Ann Gross bill gives us really builds on the current authority that we have to do background checks. But the reason we've come in and are in the bill is probably something completely different than the state agencies, and that is what the Department of Homeland Security, the Transportation Security Administration, and so forth is asking us to do these days. In the course of completing the Ann Gross version in Government Affairs Committee, we discovered a problem or two with our inclusion in the bill, and we committed to House Government Affairs that we would fix that. And that's what the -5 amendments are that you have. They've submitted those as a package, part of the -1 through -8s. Essentially, what the -5 does are two things. It would give us expanded background check authority only for prospective employees and prospective contractors. And that's a change that we've made in an agreement with the committee. The -5s also deal with the issue that Representative Garrard brought up, which is the immunity issue. And what I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, if it's okay with you, is to ask Helen Colliner to address that piece of the -5s.
Thank you. Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, again, I'm Helen Colliner, attorney at TriMet for the record. There are obviously a couple of questions related to the immunity provision, and I can't speak to the nature of the immunity overall, but with respect to our proposed language as applicable to TriMet, I think that it is actually much narrower than what is being currently understood. Under our existing authority, under the current statute, we have immunity from any sort of lawful disclosure related to the processing of these criminals' records checks. It doesn't grant immunity for decision-making, for compliance with the statutory process. It is only for disclosures of information. So our amended language is designed to replace in part what was recommended to be taken out, which was to remove any immunity for any lawful disclosure. So it only applies to lawful disclosures. It only actually applies to a subset of lawful disclosures. We expected, given the request to eliminate the immunity language, that there was some concern about the breadth of the immunity provision for disclosures. So we gave a lot of thought to those particular circumstances where we would anticipate having to make disclosures to persons other than the subject of the records check. And those three circumstances are outlined in the Dash 5 amendments. The first one is for the purpose of providing notice to the subject individual or the employer. Many of the circumstances where we expect that these background checks will arise is in circumstances where it is actually the employee of an entity that we contract with for services, be it a transportation provider that we contract with that has drivers that work for them, or an engineering firm if we're working on a capital project and they have individual engineers that are within their employ. We would be conducting background checks, obviously, on the individuals, but depending upon the outcome of the investigation, we would need to provide notice to both the individual and to the individual's employee to provide an explanation as to why that person couldn't be assigned to a TriMet project. So in making that dual disclosure, we want to ensure that that can't be characterized as a wrongful disclosure of private facts. The second is as required by law. We are the federal regulations and the federal guidelines is really in a state of flux, and we expect there will be further developments. There may be circumstances under which we are asked or required to provide certain information to them. We just want to ensure that that requirement is accurately reflected in our statute, because that is a possibility. And lastly, there may be circumstances where we have made a decision to deny someone employment because of a prior conviction pursuant to the process that we adopt, so a conviction that has some identifiable link to a security concern. That person may potentially bring a claim that their failure to hire is based upon some other reason, presumably some unlawful reason, and we would need to be able to respond. And the way we would respond is to present the valid reason for the non-hiring decision. That would, of course, be implicated as necessary to support a claim or defense. Those are the three narrow circumstances where we identified that disclosures would be necessary, that these disclosures would be lawful, and rather than having a broad provision granting us immunity from all disclosures, that this would safely carve out the protection that we needed.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Girard.
Ms. Callender, can you give me an example of a TriMet project that you'd need to have a record check for?
Yes, this is, I have to say, we're borrowing our examples in large part from the examples provided to us by the security personnel at the FTA and the mass transit personnel at Homeland Security. But generally, those circumstances, and it's actually reflected in the language of...
No, ma'am, I just name a job. That's all I'm asking you to do. I don't want to
You could be an engineer. Like, if we were designing a certain facility and a person, by virtue of the work that they were doing on the project, would have intimate information about where our system is vulnerable, where somebody could launch an attack and be assured the highest level of damage and personal harm. If someone has access to that information by virtue of their job function, that would be the kind of situation where we would be expected to do some sort of background check.
Boy, that is a real stretch.
So the questions from the committee? Yes, Representative McPherson.
I'll direct this to Ms. Colliner. I see that there are these provisions on immunity specifically for TriNet in the bill, and this is a fairly dense bill, and I'm just trying to kind of absorb what's going on in it, but it would seem as though the need for immunity that you're speaking to in the A5 amendments would be not peculiar to just the circumstances of TriNet, but might relate to other agencies that are using the same authority, and I'm wondering, isn't there better to have some kind of uniformity in the way we approach that issue throughout the bill?
We only propose the specific language because we have a separate statute. TriMet's actually addressed in a separate statute. So some of the immunity changes that were made for the general statutes were mirrored in ours, but it's actually addressed to separate places. But it is possible that those same issues could arise relative to criminal background checks in other contexts.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Looks like none. Thank you very much for your testimony, and I'll call up the next panel. Andrea Meyer, Martin Petoni, and Karen Turnbow. And we have two more witnesses after this.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU. Actually, Chair Ackerman, I apologize. I didn't check mark either box because the ACLU would support this if some changes were put in this bill. The ACLU's had concerns about doing fingerprint checks on people who are not suspected of criminal activity. And I want to go into a little bit of the history of this in this body over the last 15 years because I think we need some context for the discussion you're having today. Increased attention to using fingerprint background checks started in the early 1990s, focusing on protecting children. In 1993, I believe it was, TSPC sought authority to do nationwide criminal history checks on teachers and principals. At the same time, school districts asked for the authority to do checks for all employees who have contact with children, and the Department of Education sought authority to do fingerprint background checks on school bus drivers. Now, our opposition and concern at the time was premised on a number of factors that I want to go into. One, the use of fingerprint background checks assumes someone is guilty and must prove their innocence. Two, we object to turning over to the FBI fingerprints because of its long history of violating the constitutional rights of individuals. Three, we believed it wrong to send fingerprints of innocent people to the FBI without safeguards to prevent the FBI from adding those fingerprints to a database. Four, we were concerned that people who committed minor offenses or even major offenses at a young age might be barred from employment merely because of their past history, even though that history was irrelevant to their ability to safely, and I mean that for everyone involved, perform their job. Finally, we were concerned that widespread distribution of criminal history backgrounds would make it more difficult for a rehabilitated offender to move on with their lives, which undermines, of course, the state's interest in rehabilitating offenders. In other words, we were concerned and are concerned with which employees have access to criminal history information of a person and how that information is treated. So in response to our concerns many years ago, the legislature included safeguards in school-related statutes. One, we ensure that there is a nexus between the person who is fingerprinted and the job. In other words, by statute, not by administrative rule, there was a clear limit on the scope of which persons would be subjected to this check. Two, there was what's called the fitness determination, or a 670.280, which is not in your bill, it's a standalone elsewhere, and I don't know why, but it states in part, a licensing board commission, or agency may not deny, suspend, or revoke an occupational or professional license solely for the reason that the applicant or licensee has been convicted of a crime, but it may consider the relationship of the facts which support the conviction and all intervening circumstances to the specific occupational or professional standards in determining the fitness of the person who receives or holds the licenses. Three, another safeguard was that no permit records of the fingerprints of law-abiding individuals would be retained by the FBI or any state agency by requiring the prints to be returned or destroyed. Four, requiring that the prints not be forwarded to the FBI if the FBI's return and destroy policy changed and they began, in fact, to keep or make copies of the fingerprints. Now, I have to tell you that a lot of people still today in this building, outside this building, don't believe it, even though the FBI does have a policy of return and destroy, that that's really happening. And, of course, we all get a little bit more concerned because fingerprints are now set through data technology, not the actual cards that can be, you know, shredded. So there's increasing abilities to disseminate and risks involved when we send them through computer links. Finally, another safeguard was to protect dissemination of criminal history information. This was done, again, in the school context, by a school district submitting their prints to the Department of Education for non-certified and TSPC covering certified. And then those two entities made the analysis and the determination of the fitness rather than disseminating this confidential information to the local entities and districts. So we kind of constrained and restrained where this information went. Since this time, the legislature has expanded the use of fingerprints to vulnerable people and children in other areas. Now, the Oregon State Police invited the ACLU to discuss House Bill 2157 at the beginning, and I have a huge file, and this is, as you're gathering today, a pretty dense topic. Their purpose was to provide a uniform scheme by statute with the increasing number of agencies and departments seeking authority to obtain fingerprint checks. It seems each session there's little increases here and there. And layered on this was a whole scheme through executive order for doing fingerprints that didn't necessarily track state laws, protective schemes. We support the attempt to organize and streamline some of the safeguards, but today I want to focus on two major concerns of this bill, one that's been touched on somewhat, but I want to talk about it, another that's not. The legislature should not give the authorized agencies, and by that I mean everyone in the bill, and I just take a moment to kind of, I think I want to explain a little bit of the layout in the bill. You've got the first section and section two, which has been a lot of discussion, that sort of lays out the scheme of the process and procedures. Sections three and onward basically are the statutory authority for each and every agency, department, anyone who wants in. Some of them have already existed in law, and we're just tying them in to be consistent with this new uniform procedure. And then it's kind of been a free-for-all, and I'll go into that. In fact, it brings in large numbers of organizations. From the original bill, I believe, and this has now increased, especially with the Dash Amendments, there are 25 new sections in this bill since it was first introduced. And this, of course, is expanding almost that amount, the authority of folks to collect fingerprints and obtain nationwide criminal background checks. There is a name check that can be done. And ironically, anyone can get a name check on anyone through the Oregon State Police by paying $15. Representative Gerard, you could get one on me, or I could get one on you for $15. And you will only know that if I've sought one on you, if you indeed have a record. And then they are going to be sending me that record based on a name check. You will get notice that I've requested this, otherwise you don't. But then the fingerprint checks are triggered either for some statewide or when we do the FBI. And as you've already heard, the need for the statutory scheme is because the FBI requires it. And I think as a policy, this body needs to look at and determine who should get that authority. But under this current version of the bill, there are literally thousands of individuals who will be swept up in this bill. As I spoke about earlier, the original focus of these laws premised on the concept that persons affected had primary contact with children and vulnerable persons. In other cases, agencies have come forward with some very limited expansion on this concept. But there's been a strong history of requiring the limited scope to be articulated and put in statute, not rules. This proposal leaves it to each authorized entity or agency to come up with their own rules limiting the scope with absolutely no legislative guidance, safeguards, or limitations. We think that you should insist that each entity that wants to be included set forth clear and limiting scope of need. Now, there are good examples of that in the bill that I'm talking about, and I want to direct your attention. Section 21, which is on page 19. is the Oregon Military Department. It's already currently in the law. And it sets forth a nexus between the individual and the responsibility triggering the fingerprint bills. It wants fingerprint background checks for those who are assigned to at-risk youth alternative education programs, are issued firearms or munitions, have fiscal or purchasing responsibilities as their primary responsibility. I like that language. It focuses when you have a fiduciary duty, the primary responsibility, or regular access to restricted areas within the military installation. Another example of a group that came prepared to be added to the bill with limiting language was DEQ, and they're found on page 48. And there, they have limited, again, the scope of who could even be qualified to get, who can be have fingerprints taken of them, was those who are in the department lab or those who are dealing with chemical warfare agents. Again, they've limited it by statute. It's not everyone. Some authorized agencies came to the meeting prepared to limit and define the scope, but others have maintained that it should have broad authority of the law, and that's what went forward. And as a result, no one was really required to put a limiting scope. Instead, we are to trust that it will be appropriately handled in rulemaking. And rulemaking can handle it, but how do you challenge the policy decision? That's what we do here today. A rule could set forth the broad, broad scope, including the janitors, and I don't know what grounds you'd have to challenge that that's not a good policy decision. As long as it complied with the other rules necessary, it would fly. The scope of this is tremendously... the language that was adopted for many authorized entities is very broad. It allows them to obtain fingerprint checks, including a nationwide FBI check for anyone employed or seeking employment with a department or agency, regardless of the job, and anyone who provides services or seeks to provide services as contractor, vendor, or volunteer. And I know, Chair Ackerman, you've touched on that. That scope is tremendously broad. Imagine all the vendors alone that provide to various state agencies and departments. Are we talking about those who deliver paper, computer supplies? What's the limitation that the policy is being put forward here? We believe we shouldn't leave it up to rulemaking to ensure the limiting scope. I want to give you some examples, because this bill is so long, of the entities that have the broad language of the employer, employee, or vendor-vendee contractor. Oregon State Fair and Exposition Center, Oregon Department of Administrative Services, Department of Transportation, Department of State Lands. To be fair, they already apparently had some very broad language in the earlier law. Department of Revenue, Judicial Department, Secretary of State, Oregon Board of Dentistry. This one and a few others seem odd, because most of the licensing boards have actually just limited to those who are seeking licenses and not the employees of the board and others, and vendors, contractors. State Parks and Recreation Department, the Legislative Administrative Committee. Now, this is particularly troublesome because no one showed up. I don't know what the reason for including them was. We never heard a basis articulated. That means actually all the staff people here would be fingerprinted. Those left out, of course, would be the lobbyists and the legislators. I'm also not clear on the contested case process that would occur because of this is the legislative branch and what system would be set up to even do that. But I see we don't see any basis for them to be swept into here on the front end. Board of Naturopathic Examiners, again, they go beyond licensees in this. Appraiser, certification, licensor boards do the same. State Department of Fish and Wildlife. And today, in the amendments, we have the Oregon Student Assistant Commission. Again, the broad, broad language. Oregon University System, Clinical Social Workers, Public Utility Commission, Department of Justice, and the Forestry Department. Now, there may be very good reasons for each of these departments and agencies to fingerprint some. But they should articulate the limiting scope in statute consistent with past practices. We urge this committee to require agencies to limit criminal history checks to only those individuals who have access to vulnerable clients, such as children and the elderly, or positions that could give rise to the theft, fraud, or embezzlement. As I mentioned before, the military department uses the example fiscal or purchasing responsibilities as their primary responsibilities. There may be other unique examples, but it should be up to those agencies to articulate and limit them in scope. Our second concern. It's caught up in the first page. The legislature should not remove the Oregon Lottery Commission from the procedural safeguards, which they are under this version. Currently, Oregon Lottery has the authority to collect fingerprints for nationwide criminal history checks. Quote, for the purpose of requesting and receiving the fingerprint checks, the Oregon State Lottery Commission is a state agency. If the legislature grants the commission the authority for fingerprint background checks through the Oregon State Police and the FBI, which is the only process they can use, it should require the same safeguards apply to the lottery commission employees and contractors as to other agencies. If a prospective lottery employee is denied employment because of an inaccurate criminal history information, he or she should be able to challenge that determination just like any other state employees covered under House Bill 2157. DHS, and you will hear shortly, I hope, from Georgina Carroll from DHS, who's got a lot of history and can probably answer a number of your questions here today, has stated that there is a 50% review rate that changes the disposition of someone by providing the person being able to provide updated or accurate information that the background check did not provide. That risk is equal to the Oregon State Lottery Commission, and I see no good justified reason that they should be omitted. They do a huge number of checks. With these changes, the ACLU would be willing to support passage of 2157. We believe it's better to avoid the piecemeal approach that has occurred over the years, and we all benefit by setting up a better process that provides privacy protections to individuals. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Let's take the rest of the panel, and let's look at the clock. I think we raised a lot of issues. I urge you not to be repetitious. I remind you, even though it doesn't look like it outside, this is June. The longer you take to get through this committee, the longer it takes to get to the House floor, the less chances your bill has to get to the Senate and to the governor. So I'm just urging you to be as brief as you can. I don't want to cut off your testimony, but we've read the bill, we've heard the testimony, and we really have to move it on if we want to get these bills out. That's just a frank statement. Okay.
Chair Ackerman, thank you, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. My name is Martin Pitioni. I'm the executive director for the Board of Psychologist Examiners. In the interest of your reminder statement, I will limit myself solely to the concerns that have been raised here in this committee hearing today. The very quick bottom line from the perspective of this health regulatory licensing board, which is probably very similar to the other boards that either are already in the bill or are requesting to be in the bill in some of the amendments before you today, is basically that we are seeking the authority to verify information that the boards currently get as part of the application process but simply have no way of verifying. That's why we're seeking this authority. Now, I want to address the concerns of the committee today a little bit with respect to the intent. I'm not a lawyer. I can't speak to all of the technical language in the bill. But I think the intent is that I think the boards do understand that there is such a thing that is possible as false positives, and it will happen, particularly when you start testing large numbers of applicants and licensees who would be conducting services to vulnerable individuals. Yes, we do want an appeal process. My suspicion is that there is actually an appeal process in the bill, but it's not a contested case process per se. I would like to check on that. I think boards always get a little bit nervous when everything goes right away into a contested case process, which is a very lengthy and expensive proceeding. But I can also, I think, assure you that this board would not be interested in a bill that would not allow for some form of an appeal of a false positive on a criminal background check. Licensing is a privilege, not a right. The boards, most of the boards at least from what I understand, are limiting their authority to licensees and applicants and are not getting into the issue of employees and subcontractors and vendors. I want to assure you that we do not want, that the boards do not want black and white authority, such as if there is a negative that comes back on a criminal background check, that that means that the license will be denied. What we want is the information so that the boards can decide what to do with that information appropriately, and that the human factor that I think Representative Galicio referred to earlier can be brought into the equation. That's, I think, roughly where the boards are at with respect to this legislation. Finally, I'd just like to quickly urge the committee to adopt the -A8 amendments. There is a technical fix particular to this agency that's important to us that puts us on the same level as the other boards in the bill. Thank you.
Okay, next, please.
My name is Bob Keith. Thank you, Chair Ackerman and members of the committee. I'm the administrator of the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board, and we're here in support of 2157A. And our portion of the bill is in Section 59. Our board exists as a result of federal legislation, which was in response to the savings and loan crisis of the 80s. And because appraisers are in an opinion business, it's imperative that they act in a manner which is trustworthy, honest, and in good faith. appraisers also have an ethical obligation to be objective, impartial, and independent in their conclusions in valuing property. Because mortgage fraud and appraisal fraud is rampant across the country, and because it is becoming a concern in Oregon, as evidenced by the fact that the FBI came to our office a couple weeks ago with interest in several appraisers, we believe that it is imperative that the board have the ability to perform criminal background checks, in particular because appraisers who in-migrate from other states and make applications, all they have to do is simply lie on their license application with regard to any past criminal activity. And we're particularly concerned about those types of crimes that involved an appraiser's honesty and trustworthiness, fraud, embezzlement, theft, misrepresentation, things of that nature. And I'd like to introduce Karen Turnbow, who is from our office. Karen's been very active in the work group.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Turnbow. I am the office manager and current LEDS representative for the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board. As Mr. Keith previously advised, the board is in favor of this bill that would provide the appraiser board the ability to conduct fingerprint national background checks. The board, in 1991, the legislature recognized the need for the appraiser board to have the authority to conduct nationwide criminal background checks, and actually we have a statute, which is ORS 674-170, that allowed the appraiser board to conduct those background checks. Unfortunately, the legislative language was not specific to fingerprint, to include the term fingerprint in its national background language, and since 1991 we've been unable to conduct fingerprint background checks nationwide because of that insufficient language in our statute. This bill would correct that insufficiency. In the past, recognizing the need for the bill, I'd like to point out that there have been three occasions over the last couple of years where we have had either an appraiser applicant or actually licensed appraisers here in Oregon that have failed to disclose felony convictions from out of state on their applications as required as part of their application. The only way that we found out about those convictions was through outside parties contacting our agency and saying, did you know about this? In each instance, the applicant was denied for failing to disclose. The one applicant actually had a warrant for his arrest for felony hit and run and then fleeing the state. That we would have not known about had it not been for an outside party contacting us. The other two instances where the appraisers were actually licensed in our state and we subsequently found out about their out-of-state criminal convictions resulted in either revocation of their license or voluntary surrender. Now, those revocations and surrender were not related to specifically to the crime that they committed, but rather their failure to disclose those convictions, which went to their trustworthiness in failing to disclose those.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? I guess there are none. Again, thank you for your testimony and your participation. I'm going to call up the last panel, and I have Vicki Chamberlain, Kevin Neely, and Georgina Caro. Please keep in mind the time situation. If you're I know that at least two of the three of you are agency representatives, so really need to know what your position is. You want to in or out, and if in, why? Okay. But again, I'd like to see if we can conclude this as quickly as we can because of the time constraints.
Chair,
you may proceed in any manner you wish.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. The amendments adopted in general government inadvertently took out the phrase, we're here in support of the A6 amendments that subjects us to Section 2 of the Act. It was in the original bill. It was a typographical error, and rather than hold the bill up, we're here to get that fixed.
Thank you. Next.
Chair Ackerman, I'm Georgina Carroll from the Department of Human Services. I manage the Criminal Records Unit, and the department has been doing criminal background checks for about 20 years. Since 1997, we've been operating under ORS 181-537, which gives us authority to do national and state background checks. We have extensive experience in this. We do about 15,000 subject individuals a month, so we have quite extensive experience in terms of applying this for employment purposes, but also assuring that the vulnerable citizens we provide services for are protected and provided the best services. You had asked a number of questions earlier that I might be able to answer, but given the time, I'll just yield to the chair if you want me to try to answer some of the questions.
Fine. We'll see what the committee says. The three of us that are here.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would be curious about on the question of reliability of the records that are being pursued, since you have such broad experience. I'd be interested in hearing, what's the error rate? How often are there misidentified people or people being unfairly tagged with a criminal record that's not theirs?
Mr. Chair, there's actually two parts to the question around records and what we receive. There's the criminal history itself, both the state record and the national record, which is obtained by fingerprints. And then there's also in the statute a requirement to gather a whole bunch of other information, which is in section 12 and 13 of the Engross version. Accuracy is probably, I'd say, 1 out of 100 records we have to look at, do a second, check to see whether the applicant's name, birth date, and Social Security or any other identifiers we have all match up. And we do that very quickly. If there is any question of identity, we submit fingerprints and we rely on the results of the FBI records. We have very little indication that the national records coming back have any flaws in identity. We are pretty good at determining when an identity is in question. Our staff have done this extensively. So it's really not an issue for us. If there is a question for the subject individual, we always encourage them to get their own criminal history, either obtain that through Oregon State Police or the FBI.
Okay, further questions from the committee? All right, may proceed.
I just wanted to also mention that
I was calling on the other witness.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Did you want to?
In the interest of time, I just have to do this. If we're going to get your bill through, we got to get going.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Neely, Oregon Department of Justice. I will be incredibly brief. We have some amendments to this bill, which I haven't seen yet, that would essentially, one of our concerns is that existing criminal justice agencies that are already authorized to do federal criminal background checks are pulled into this process. We want to make sure that the status quo with those agencies continues. We have amendments that will so do that. And again, as soon as I get a chance to see them and look more closely at them, I'll be able to report fully about their actual, whether or not they actually do that.
Okay, thank you. Okay, now, any further questions from the committee? Has everyone testified? I guess you have. Okay, thank you very much. Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2157? Please come forward. Okay, seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2157 and entertain a short discussion with the board or with the committee. It's been the policy of the committee to submit a clean product to the committee as a whole, and we're supposed to do the work here in resolving differences, making sure that all the amendments are in shape and the bill is structurally correct for the full committee to work. To work it out on a very simple work session. I think there's some problems with this bill we should resolve at this level. I want to get my agenda out, colleagues, and then ask for your guidance as to whether we should proceed to a work session or hold the public hearing at another time to resolve these issues. As I viewed the testimony this morning, I think the following issues are outstanding. Whether this should be limited to employees in positions of public trust, that have worked with sensitive materials or data or serve vulnerable populations. I realize this can be handled in rulemaking, but I don't see that it says that in the text of the bill, and I think we should give more guidance to rulemaking. Secondly, I think there's a structural problem with respect to saying that all agencies under 174.110 are included, and then we have a bunch of folks submitting amendments saying they want in. I think you have to decide whether 174.110 comes out and everybody opts in, or whether we use 174.110 and everybody's covered. I think we need some further discussion on the conclusive evidence that is will be forwarded in the APA hearing. I think there's two issues regarding immunity, whether it should apply at all, and whether, consistent with Representative McPherson's inquiry, whether it should be uniform, in other words, to apply to all agencies rather than every agency coming in with their own view of immunity. I would like some statement from as to why the Lottery Commission is excluded. There was a point that was raised, but I don't know why they're excluded. And I guess we have some amendments coming from the AG's office. So this is kind of the direction that I see. Committee members, do you have any suggestions for us?
Well, as a committee member, I would feel more comfortable in allowing some of these issues to be addressed before we do move it with a recommendation to the full committee. So I would concur with you.
Representative McPherson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, this bill is very difficult to deal with because it's got this collection of provisions addressing particular agencies. I'd be a lot more comfortable with a bill that established a broad policy that was more conceptual and didn't, and maybe at the risk of changing the applicable statutory scheme for particular agencies that have sought the authority in the past, had a broad policy decision made. I realize that's quite a different direction from where the bill is now, and I fear that pursuing such an aim might prevent us from moving anything this session. So I'm open to working with this product. It needs some more work, and the fact that we have amendments up to H-12 already pending means that we've got fair amount of work here to do. I think I will not be very happy with the work product if we stay on the course that this bill is on.
Okay. Let me ask Representative McPherson a question. I get the drift from your comments that maybe the following should be entertained. That is, that we cover all, say, for the sake of argument, cover all executive agencies and allow them then to opt out rather than have everybody come in with a -14, -18, -54 amendment saying they want in. Was that what you were thinking about?
Yeah, that's right. A general standard that applies to everybody, and in fact, if we this is a grant of authority. It's not requiring anybody to do anything. So if we grant broad authority to a range of agencies, or maybe to all executive agencies of the state, if they meet certain standards, then that applies to everyone, and there's not even a need for them to opt out. They simply choose not to exercise that authority. And if we, as a policy decision, conclude that we want to limit it to people who, to background checks on individuals who are going to be working with vulnerable populations or in a position of fiscal responsibility, then we could do that as a policy decision applied to everybody. But I'm uncomfortable having that be a standard for some agencies and not for others. Seems to me that policy ought to span everybody, even if that means it's going to be a departure for some agencies from where they have gotten themselves in prior legislation.
Okay. I think that expresses the concerns of the committee and what work we think we have to have done before this comes back to another public hearing. I don't know who the drivers are on this. Obviously, you're going to have to break down into a smaller, more cohesive group to get this work done, but I think that we should have representatives from the AG's office, representatives from the agencies, and perhaps TriMet and other associated entities and the American Civil Liberties Union to come back with these concerns. Council? You raise your hand, or you just...
No.
Oh, okay. Okay. I was willing to be corrected, okay. You'll have to decide that for yourself, but I would like to report back to council as to who would be the specific people in this study group or this work group so that we can get you together and try to facilitate our concerns. Okay, so with that, the discussion regarding House Bill 2157 is concluded by the committee, and we will... move into a public hearing on House Bill 2693. Council?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2693 and the -1 amendments, which are gut and stuff amendments, provide that having evidence of marijuana in one system qualifies as medical use of marijuana. It also provides that employers are not required to accommodate the use of medical marijuana, regardless if it happens at the workplace, and it provides that nothing in the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, or OMMA, will preclude an employer from establishing or enforcing a policy to achieve or maintain a drug-free workplace. This bill is in response to a recent court appeals decision, Washburn versus Columbia Forest Products. That case held that employers were required to accommodate an employee who tested positive for marijuana unless the employer could show that the employee smoked the marijuana at the workplace. I also want to make a note that the Supreme Court today issued its decision on Reich versus Ashcroft, and it may or may not make this a moot point, but basically the Supreme Court held that the federal government can prosecute individuals who are using marijuana under Medical Marijuana Acts. So I'm not sure exactly how that will come into play here, but that's something that's going to be obviously overlying this issue.
Yes, I just received also a copy of that opinion, and I'll can share it with others later. It's something that's just decided today.
Today or yesterday?
Yeah, it was in the news
this morning.
Okay, thank you. We have 9 witnesses on this, and it looks like it's almost evenly decided or distributed between pros and cons. I got probably 2 more than that. I'm going to try to call the proponents first. I think we're going to have a time problem because of session beginning in 1.5 hours. So this is going to have to come back. We're going to have to analyze the Supreme Court decision, which was just rendered today, evidently. So let's go forth with Lisa Trussell, Pamela, looks like Barron, and Madeline Martinez. I was going to, let's see if I get here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with AOI, and we're distributing to you some testimony from Jerry Jeswald with Serenity Lane, who was unable to attend the hearing today. But we're here today in support of House Bill 2693 with the -1 amendments. And in Mr. Jezebel's testimony, he also covers a bill that you have further down on the agenda, House Bill 2873 as well. And as Mr. Sears mentioned, these bills have become necessary because of the Washburn versus Columbia Forest Products case, and because of the increasing numbers of individuals with medical marijuana cards. Our members have a responsibility to provide a safe workplace under a variety of state and federal laws, and those include occupational health and safety as well as compliance with the federal anti-drug initiatives. And Mr. Jeswald points out in his testimony that in the past 18 months, he's assisted 20 employers who had employees test positive for THC and then presented a medical marijuana card after the fact. He also points that out that unlike other medicines, there's no dosage recommendations for medical marijuana. According to him, regular use of marijuana leads to forgetfulness, lack of motivation, and complacency, and I think that's on the second page of his testimony. For employers responsible for providing a safe workplace, that's clearly a problem. He also raises an interesting point that there is no requirement under the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act for an applicant to be evaluated for abuse or dependency issues prior to getting the card. With me today is Paula Barron, and she's a defense attorney partner in Barron Liebman, and I'd like Paula to address some of the technical aspects of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Morning.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as Lisa mentioned, my name is Paula Barron. I am with Barron Liebman. We represent employers, and not just as a defense attorney, but much of my work, perhaps the majority of it, is working with employers to help them comply with the vast array of laws that businesses must comply with. Those have grown exponentially in the years that I've been in practice. I also work with employers on drug and alcohol policies. As you may be aware, there are a host of federal regulations that actually require Oregon employers to and other employers in other states to have testing policies. Many of these emanated from 1988 federal legislation following a massive accident between an Amtrak train and a Conrail train that public testimony demonstrated was caused in large part by the drug use of the operating employees. That led to the transportation testing so that those of us who regularly travel the I-5 corridor understand that the drivers of those large rigs are at least required to be drug and alcohol free in the performance of their duties. But there has been a disparity between federal and state law ever since the Oregon Initiative adopted medical marijuana in this state, and part of what I'd like to do is to at least outline some of the issues that cause us to ask this committee to consider these amendments seriously, but also I'd like to address the Wright case, which counsel referenced this morning, because I've been following that for some time. By way of background, marijuana is a wholly illegal substance under federal law. It sits on Schedule I of the Controlled Substances Act, so right up there with LSD. So under federal law, nobody can use it. There are no medical exceptions to its use. It is simply absolutely, completely illegal. When the 11 states that have adopted medical marijuana statutes, largely by the initiative process, which means they're largely in the West, like Oregon, there was immediately created this disparity between federal and state law. So just by way of background, we have this conflict. The federal government has consistently said states cannot authorize marijuana. The states have consistently said we believe that we may do so within the confines of our own state. And in Oregon's particular case, medical marijuana legislation was brought and begun by the initiative process, and it was begun solely as an exception to the criminal laws of the state, so that users of medical marijuana, provided it was authorized in accordance with the state statute, could understand and believe that they would at least be free from state prosecution. It said nothing about federal law because, of course, at that stage, state law could say nothing about federal law. And that's where the Reich versus Ashcroft case comes in. I think the name may have switched now. Mr. Ashcroft has now been replaced by Mr. Gonzalez, so the operative title is probably Reich versus Gonzalez. And the issue there was whether or not, in this case, California's state statute could exist in light of federal law. In other words, does a state have the authority to regulate the use of marijuana within the four corners of the state, within the geographical boundaries of the state? And the parties involved were using it solely intrastate. They did not traffic in it. They did not trade in it. And as you're aware, this morning, the Supreme Court issued that decision. It was argued in November, so it has taken the court some time to issue the decision, and they have upheld the supremacy of the Federal Controlled Substances Act and concluded that states do not have the authority to supersede federal law. They do not have the authority to pass these laws. Now, that places, of course, Oregon's medical marijuana statute in some odd position, and I suspect this body will want to have a look at it. However, I would suggest and urge this committee to consider these amendments nonetheless, because I do not believe that they are rendered moot. You'll recall when Oregon's medical marijuana statute was adopted, we still had a federal law that said marijuana is illegal. The Supreme Court certainly clarifies the uneasy status of that law, but until the statute itself is looked at, the many, many employers in this state, many of whom are very small, need and deserve from this body some guidance about how to deal with the many employees they have who have medical marijuana cards. So I'd like to talk a little bit about why, some of the background about why this is an issue, and I'll touch briefly on the Washburn case just by way of background. As I mentioned, when the state...
How much more time are you going to need? I don't know where you are in your testimony. Could you give me an idea? Because we only have about less than 10 minutes before we have to...
I would anticipate that, unless you want to boot me out, I would probably occupy the whole time.
Well, I'm not going to be able to accommodate that right now.
Okay.
And I'm saying that not only because of the time problem, but because of the Supreme Court case holding that, basically, I think, outlawing medical marijuana, perhaps this discussion is going to be moot. We're going to have to come back and direct our discussion to that case when we have a better opportunity to absorb it. So I think that's kind of an overriding legal issue for us to decide between now and the next time we have a public hearing. So I'd like to get a couple more witnesses out of the way if I possibly could.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'd be pleased to come back if you have further hearings on this.
Sure.
And if you... I'm certainly going to yield to what you would prefer.
I'd like to try to get two or three more witnesses out, if I possibly could, on the next panel within the next 5 minutes. Okay.
I'm happy to accommodate.
I apologize for cutting you short, but there is an overriding legal problem that we have to consider. Okay. Questions from the committee? I'll leave you here for questions, though.
Okay.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would, not a question, but a comment, and I certainly would like to have the presentation from Ms. Barron as we move forward in most likely another public hearing on this matter. So.
Okay. Any questions? Hearing none, we'll call up the next panel. Henry Snow. There's a Ken Roloffs, I think. I'm trying to read your writing. And there's Joe Miller and Jessica Adamson. Take four at a time if I can possibly do it. But I may have to arbitrarily shut you off until we get to session.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Henry Snow. I'm Vice President of Human Relations and Human Resources at Roseburg Forest Products. We employ about 3,500 employees in the state, and most of those employees are in manufacturing facilities, and most are represented by unions. We have substance abuse policies negotiated with those unions. I don't know if the federal law today, the court case, will modify the situation. I'm here to tell you that I have a safety issue, and I have a costly, expensive legal proposition in front of me in dealing with employees that have medical marijuana cards. Our substance abuse policy allows for rehabilitation, a last chance agreement on the first time employees test positive for not only marijuana, but other illegal substances. So we try to rehabilitate those employees. The second chance, employees lose their jobs. We are litigating currently one case, and we have two others pending in the wings. This is very expensive for our company, and we have not been able to find physicians nor toxicologists that are willing to draw a bright line and say when we can judge whether impairment exists or does not exist. We need help, and we're not sure that the Supreme Court decision will render that help. So we're asking for your help, and we would like you to support the amendments in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next witness.
Chairman Ackerman, members of the committee, My name is Ken Rolas, and I work for TOC Management Services. TOC is an employers association, and we have about 530 members in the Northwest. My area is in Oregon, and I help our members comply with employment law. I have assisted about 10 members with medical marijuana issues, and in case I'd like to share with you today is basically the ease in which employees can obtain medical marijuana cards. One of our members had an employee who tested positive in a pre-employment drug test for marijuana, and he was in the process of obtaining a medical marijuana card, and he supplied the company with the information, and basically what was going on is that he had a chronic low back condition that produced pain. Basically, his doctor said that he came into the office and told him that he's used marijuana. It helps his pain. The doctor says, basically, he says, I shared with the patient that I neither recommend nor prescribe marijuana for my patients who choose to use it, and since it is illegal and I'm not a lawyer, I cannot give informed consent about its use. He may use a copy of this dictation for his own end. And he provided that to the state, and the state provided a medical marijuana card based on that, even without a doctor's recommendation. Most of our members have manufacturing plants that require an employee to be very careful at work. They drive forklifts. They operate equipment. If they come in under the influence of marijuana, then they can injure themselves or others, and therefore we're in support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next. And again, we're subject to gaveling out at, on the minute.
I'll be brief. Chairman Ackerman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Miller, Safety and Loss Control Manager for the Oregon-Columbia Chapter of AGC. We have a staff of approximately 9 consultants that provide safety and health consultative services to our approximately 1,100 members. Most of those members currently have drug and alcohol programs to maintain a drug-free workplace and fervently believe that they are a significant factor in reducing injuries to their employees. Construction is a physically strenuous and sometimes hazardous occupation. Activities such as operating heavy equipment like cranes, forklifts, and bulldozers, working from elevations, and operating power tools requires the employee's full attention, free from impairment. We believe that the amendments to House Bill 2693 are necessary for our members to maintain their current drug and alcohol programs and protect all of their employees. Thank you.
Thank you. Next.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Harris-Adamson with Associated General Contractors. I would simply add that many of our members are union signatory and likewise have drug and alcohol free policies as part of that union agreement. Many of our open shop folks as well have those kind of policies for the exact reasons that Mr. Miller just stated. And finally, Oregon's public contracting law has a specific provision that every public contract for public improvements, which are construction projects, must contain a provision that there's a drug testing program in place for that company on that job site and also contractors thereof. So this is a very important issue, especially for those that build your roads, bridges, schools, etc.
Fine, thank you. Other questions from the committee? Seeing none. Thank you very much. And considering the time of day, committee, I'm going to have to bring the public hearing to a conclusion, and would be we'll have to reopen at the committee's convenience, and I will ask legal counsel to analyze the Supreme Court decision, particularly in with respect to this bill, because it does appear that medical marijuana is subject to federal prosecution, and that would have, I think, a significant effect upon the bill that's before us, but we'll have counsel make the call on that. So with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2693.
We can't proceed.
Yeah, we can.
We have a very...
Okay.
I'm just wondering if it makes sense to move it into a work session and move different amendments in and get it to fall. And then we could do it.
Well, I still think we have to get, if we move it up to the full committee, we still have this legal thing hanging out, and we haven't heard all the witnesses.
Plus, you have a lot of testimony.
Yeah, so that's true.
Yeah.
I'm not comfortable.
What bill do we want to look at?
Very short bill, but I'd like to
proceed to a very quick public hearing and work session, and that is Senate Bill 262. So with respect to that, I will open a public hearing on that. We're over our time, but I know we have some witnesses here that we need to accommodate from the notes I received. So, counsel, you want to explain this bill, and those persons here for testimony on this, please come forward.
Chair Ackerman, members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 262A comes to you from the Oregon Health Sciences University. This would extend the sunset for an exemption to the public records statute for records identifying persons engaged in research on animals at Oregon Health Sciences University. There, in 2003, this exemption to the public records statute was implemented, and the language of the exemption is that exempted from public records include the name, home address, or location of a person that is engaged in or provides goods or services for medical research at OHSU that is conducting experiments using animals other than rodents. This is the current law that is scheduled to sunset in January 2006, and under this bill, that sunset would be extended to January 2010. The amended version of the bill also expressly does not apply to information in OHSU press releases, websites, or other publications that are circulated to the general public. The measure does not exempt the substance of the research itself from disclosure, but merely the names and locations of the researchers and the individuals providing goods and services for such research.
Just to tell you, we're down to about less than 5 minutes on this one, and I want to give everyone a chance. If there's some carryover, we're just going to have to continue the public hearing later time. You may proceed in any manner you wish.
Chairman Ackerman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Leslie Halleck. I'm the provost at Oregon Health and Science University, and I'm here to testify in support of the extension of the sunset on Senate Bill 262. I'll be very brief. I have provided for you a packet that contains several items. The first is a letter, two-page letter, addressed to Representative Ackerman that explains our request. We're basically asking you to extend the sunset on a law that we believe has worked very well to protect our researchers from intimidation and violence. The members of the radical animal rights movement that object to doing research with animals have in fact mounted a campaign against researchers around the country that involves advocating violence, visitation on their house, placement of researchers on wanted posters representing their children on the web, and generally trying to intimidate scientists from conducting this research. Since I testified in behalf of this sunset extension in the Senate a few weeks ago, we have experienced 10 additional menacing acts, including 5 cases of nighttime home harassment of OHSU employees, and in fact one former employee who hadn't been an employee for a long time. In the material that I've indicated, I have the request. The second item is a list, a document of the animal activism specific to OHSU, and if you turn to the end of that, you can see some of the most recent activity at the homes of these investigators. The third item that I've provided is a list, a documentation. We've kept very careful records since the bill was enacted in 2003 of all information requests that have been received. And in particular, I want to point out that to date, not a single request from the press has been denied or redacted, so that we are extremely careful. The Tom Gallagher, who represents the Oregon Newspaper Association, actually testified with me in the Senate. He wasn't able to be here today, but he does support these, and in particular an amendment that's now incorporated into this bill that makes it clear that where we have already published the names of investigators on the web or in publications available to the public, of course, those are continue to be available. The point
I'm getting looks from my committee members. We have to be on the floor in less than 10 minutes, so if you could conclude, it might save you coming back. We're going to have to continue the public hearing under these circumstances.
Happy to conclude. I've provided with you the some examples of websites, just a few, that indicate the level of rhetoric and violence that is advocated, including suggesting forming their own cells, carrying out actions, bring bricks to the homes, and so on. So we basically request of you that you extend the sunset on this law and that we continue the careful and prudent behavior directed by the law and the documentation that we provide.
Any questions of this witness by the committee? This is the last witness we'll hear today. We're going to have to close the public hearing. No questions? I apologize for closing the public hearing. This will be reset as quickly as we possibly can, but we're in very, very severe time restraints. Further comments from the committee? And I will conclude the public hearing on Senate Bill 262. For the business of the committee, seeing none, we're adjourned.